Hi, and welcome to another episode of Uniquely Wired, an ADHD podcast. I'm your host, Shun Prochaska. I'm a coach that specializes in working with women with ADHD. And I decided to do this solo special because I'm kind of fed up with how many women I see in the media, how many women messaging me, how many women commenting on my posts on social media who are coming to me and telling me how their ADHD went undetected until, you know, their 30s or their 40s or even their 20s, and how much they suffered as a result, how much it's affected their lives, how much grief they went through when they found out, you know, later in life, what had been going on with them all along, and that they didn't know it, and how different their lives could have been had they known, had it been detected earlier on. And the simple reason that it hasn't been, that it doesn't get detected in girls as early as it does in boys, is gender bias. There's a lot more research done into how conditions affect males than there is and how they affect females. And when is that going to change? You know, it's 2021. And it's not just ADHD. There's, you know, gender bias shows up in how little research there is into menopause. How many women in, you know, are being prescribed antidepressants in their 50s when actually they need, you know, treatment for their menopause symptoms. And with ADHD, you know, I'm sure if you don't know much about it, you're going to think of the stereotype of the disruptive boy in class. And this is how boys get diagnosed earlier, because often they're showing hyperactive tendencies, they're causing trouble in class, and the teacher notices and tells the parents, and then it goes from there. With girls, ADHD looks different. Of course, there are girls who are extremely hyperactive and just as disruptive in class as boys. That happens. But there are the girls who are inattentive, who are quiet, who fade into the background and end up falling through the cracks. And by the time they leave school, they don't know who they are. They don't know what they've learned in the last, you know, 14 years. And they don't know, you know, what to do next with their lives, because maybe they didn't get into university, or maybe they believe that they have nothing to offer the world because they've always felt really stupid. That's not a word that I like to use, but I know myself, I felt stupid for most of my life until I got diagnosed 4 years ago at 35. And I just feel really strongly that I wanted to share my story and, you know, talk about everything that I went through, because it's important, because we often hear about how people struggled in class with not listening and stuff like that. But there's other stuff as well that goes on with ADHD, and there's other repercussions of having undiagnosed ADHD. And that's mainly what I'm going to talk about in this podcast. So before we start, I'd just like to give a trigger warning for suicidal thoughts and also bullying / emotionally abusive behavior from a teacher of mine. I also talk about dealing with anxiety and depression, which aren't part of an ADHD diagnosis, but are very common experiences for people with ADHD. So I just wanted to talk about how it was for me. I mean, everyone's story is going to be different, just like everyone's life is going to be different. You know, we don't experience any, you know, life the same. We don't even experience color the same. So for me, it's when I started school, what year was that now? 1986, I suppose. I remember enjoying things like spelling. I have quite, you know, clear memories of my teacher. I enjoyed singing and all of those kind of things. I remember not wanting to stick out, you know, always feeling like, oh gosh, I hope the teacher doesn't notice me, even as a very young child, wanting to kind of fit in and not be noticed. And it wasn't really until I was in, I think, third class, so I was 8 or 9 or something, and the teacher was very, how shall I say, she was very aggressive with her words. She was a nun, Catholic nun, and she did not like me.
And for years, I had no idea why. She gave me a very hard time. She would always call me, you know, call me out in front of the class for not doing this right, not doing that right. She'd call me stupid. She'd tell me I'd never amount to anything. She'd compare me to my older sister, just really nasty kind of stuff. And so looking back, I mean, this, I carried all of this with me for years until I got diagnosed. And then I started to think, my God, you know, I was probably looking out the window the whole time and not paying attention, which must have been really frustrating as a teacher. But of course, it doesn't excuse her treatment of me, not at all. But, you know, I suppose I felt like I just didn't want to be noticed, of course. So I'd never put my hand up. And if the teacher ever asked me a question, I'd be like, or like even like, what did I just say, June? And I'd be like, oh no, they saw that I wasn't paying attention. And I have no idea what they said. And I'm going to look like an idiot in front of the whole class. And school was just like that for me. It was just normal for me to feel like that. And I didn't know any different. And of course, it eats away at your confidence, especially if you're being really made a spectacle of, which this, you know, nun did to me. And my anxiety just went through the roof. And I developed, like, I guess, obsessive compulsive behaviors. I've never had that diagnosed because it doesn't really bother me anymore. But I just developed very, you know, I guess I was just looking back, I was just trying to have control over something in my life. So I would carry out these rituals, like, you know, touching something, you know, a certain amount of times and getting stuck in it and being there over and over. Anyone who has sort of AD or OCD kind of rituals will understand that you try and do something until it feels right. You could brush your hand off something accidentally and it doesn't feel right for some reason in your brain, and your brain is like, make it right. So you do it again and again and again and again, and then you'll do it in sets of, you know, four. So you'll be counting in your head to four, and then you'll do it again. And before you know it, you've done it like 60 times and you're completely off track with what you wanted to do. So that was happening a lot for me when I was, you know, 8, 9 years old, I suppose, for those 2 years I was in with that teacher. And it's not, you know, OCD is not necessarily a part of ADHD at all. It's just, that's how my anxiety manifested from, you know, having ADHD, because you're very likely to be anxious when you have ADHD.
I also remember around this age, like, I suppose more like 9, of just, you know, being up late at night, far later than my parents or anyone else, because I couldn't sleep because I was so anxious and the OCD was keeping me up too. And I remember just feeling so hopeless, like, I don't want to live anymore. If this is what life is about, I just don't want to be here. And I remember thinking, I can't let anyone know how I feel because they'll put me somewhere into some institution or something like that. You know, I didn't understand what it meant really, you know, at such a young age, but I definitely felt that kind of that shame and that feeling of potentially being such a burden to people. And I mean, my parents had no idea what was going on and they must have been out of their minds at worry. I can't even imagine. But that was a very, very common thing for me around that time.
I never told my parents about it because I thought, well, I can't pay attention in her class. So she's right to tell me these things, you know, because like nobody, there was no knowledge really of ADHD in those days. You know, it was probably seen as a sort of made up thing, and it was just like, just try harder, you know, just, you know, why can't you be like this? Why can't you do that? And there was a lot of that. And there was a lot of that for many, many people. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this can relate. And, you know, a lot of people had an awful time at school for different reasons. There just wasn't the support there in those days. There wasn't the, you know, mental health support. There wasn't really the knowledge around child development and things like that. So it was just the times that were in it, and nobody's to blame. It's just the way it was. But it's interesting looking back and seeing how ADHD left undiagnosed wreaked absolute havoc, you know, in my life anyway. And I even like, I can also even remember, I think it was in the fourth class, I was still in the classroom with her, and I was petrified of going to school every day. It felt like a kind of, I was a hostage, you know, and I was going into that really dangerous, awful situation every day. I mean, I can imagine my brain must have been absolutely firing, you know, anxious thoughts all the time. And I just felt anxious all the time. So that kind of eased, you know, when I moved into the next class up. And I always found that teachers were always asking me, what was the last thing I said? Or carry on reading where the last child left off. And of course, I never knew where they'd stopped reading because I was thinking about other stuff. I was really bored in school. And I often had to, you know, look at my neighbor's work and do what they were doing and like basically copy a load of things. Otherwise, I would have, you know, gotten into trouble. And of course, I really didn't want that. I didn't want attention to be, you know, any kind of attention from a teacher. And, you know, over time, you believe that you just can't do those things, that there's something wrong with you. You're, you know, I don't like this word, but you're stupid and you're incapable and your brain doesn't work properly. So you're like getting these messages constantly from, you know, like several times, you know, a minute, maybe sometimes, especially, you know, in those days, like if you didn't know the answer to a question, you'd be made to stand up in front of the class and, you know, there was a lot of shaming and all of that. You know, that was the way it was. And, you know, and that also compounds your feeling of being incapable and having something wrong with you, basically. So, yeah, school was a lot like that. I can remember the like leaving primary school and starting in secondary school and just kind of being, I think made my mind up in a way and was just like, okay, I might not be good at school, but what I lack in, you know, intelligence, which is what I thought at the time, I'll make up for in personality and, you know, whatever, and being a bit outrageous sometimes. So I kind of relied on, I suppose, my sense of humor, which I'm really grateful for, which a lot of people with ADHD, you know, have very playful kind of sense of humor. So I was able to get by like that. You know, having the crack, making people laugh. I just kind of made up my mind that school wasn't for me, but I had to go because everyone did. And that was that. There was no alternative. And that's kind of how I got through secondary school. And also, like, I remember there were a few teachers who I really felt didn't like me because I was never listening. And they would show their frustration. And some of them might be, I can remember one day there was one teacher who scared me. He would just shout at me. And of course that never, you know, you can't learn if you're being shouted at, that doesn't work. And of course, you know, we know that now, but I can remember, you know, asking to be excused after being shouted at one day and walking up to the bathroom and just everything started going black. And I had to sit down and put my head between my knees because I was so, you know, worked up and embarrassed and, you know, full of emotion and shame and all of those things and traumatized probably from, you know, years of being pointed out and ridiculed by some teachers that I just almost fainted. That scared me. And it got a bit better as I, you know, got a bit older. And I was just kind of, I wanted to be liked, you know, I had to fit in some way, because when you're a teenager and you were not doing great at school and you don't know why, and you believe there's something, you know, really, really wrong with your brain, you try and, you know, fit in other ways, and being, you know, being a bit kind of out there with my personality, I suppose, and sense of humor and all those kind of things. And impulsive, all those kind of things can be, you know, you can be a real clown sometimes and make people laugh and all that. And that's kind of where I got my confidence, I think, going through school, because it certainly wasn't academic prowess or anything like that. And I suppose by the time I left school, I didn't get into university. I remember cramming and studying so hard in sixth year, in the last year of school, and just really, really trying to break the spell somehow, you know, just like, if I just study, and to my frustration, of course, I'd forget everything. You know, when I was sitting in the exam, I'd forgotten all the stuff, all the notes I'd made, everything. And it's really, it can be really hard as well when you're studying, because you often don't know what's important, what you're supposed to remember. It's very confusing. So you end up trying to remember everything. And of course, it's not going to work. I remember seeing someone once recently saying, you know, showing us a picture of the desert, which was just totally flat and just sand, and saying, tell me what stands out to you in this picture. And there's nothing, there's no feature to grab onto, there's nothing. And that's what it felt like, because it was just a desert, just a flat desert with no features and nothing standing out to you. And that's what it felt like studying and trying to figure out what to learn. And so I suppose, yeah, so I ended up getting very average marks in my school leaving exam and not getting into university. And I remember that was hard, because all my, you know, my friends were moving on to different places and stuff, and I was being left behind. And I didn't realize that I had been behind for years, you know, that I couldn't see that yet, you know. But yeah, and I ended up doing a diploma in childcare, which I loved, because I love children. And learning a bit about child development and stuff. And I found that I was good at it. And I remember, you know, on the second day or something, we had to vote for who would be the class rep. And to my utter dismay, they voted me, for me to be the class rep. And I remember thinking, what? That doesn't make any sense. Sure, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what's going on most of the time. You know, that's what it felt like. And I was so surprised by that. And looking back, I have always kind of, I never really sort of noticed when people, you know, liked me, or people kind of, I don't know, you know, showed me kind of any sort of attention or, you know, things like that. I just never thought that I was somebody important or significant. I thought I was just, you know, an idiot who couldn't learn at school and probably wouldn't do much with their lives. That was the message I left school with. So that was a big surprise, and it was a confidence boost to be made class rep. I mean, looking back, I don't think I did really anything to do with being a class rep, but it was a nice thing. So it wasn't really until I was, how old was I? I was 21 when I started volunteering in Camp Hill. So if you don't know what Camp Hill is, it's like a community for young people and adults with learning disabilities, and you live there as a volunteer, and you all live in different houses, kind of like in a family structure. So there's like house managers, and then there's the carers, and I was one of the carers, and then you have your people that you take care of. And it's quite alternative. You know, you work the land, you have wood workshops, you have food processing, you have bakery, all of those kind of things, and you trade with nearby communities. And it's really lovely, really amazing place. And it wasn't until then that I just kind of it just kind of woke something up in me. I was like, oh my gosh, I fit in here. This is amazing. It was near Bristol in the UK, and I spent 2 years there, and I found that I, you know, my kind of my skills were appreciated, you know, but there was nothing to do with academia or anything like that. It was all very much like who you were as a person, I suppose, and people kind of you see people for the individual that they are, and you appreciate them for that. And I felt that for the first time, and I remember, like, it was mind-blowing for me. It was, and my confidence really grew. But I do remember, you know, often having this fog in my head that just wouldn't go away, and these moods and up and down, and, you know, a lot of loneliness and depression. And that was true for when I was a child as well, like feeling very lonely and misunderstood, and feeling depressed, you know, and just sort of like thinking there was nothing really out there and I wasn't any good at anything. So even though I found that I was good at a lot of things in the community, I still was having these, you know, serious doubts about my abilities and not feeling like a whole person, just feeling like a part person. Like there's something missing, there's something wrong. It was always going on in the back of my head, like a radio sort of at a low volume, you know, just always buzzing there, that kind of feeling. And so I ended up, I think it was, I ran a workshop in Camp Hill. I ran the bakery workshop and we'd make brownies, you know, a couple of times a week for the community. And we'd all sit outside and have tea break together. And I remember feeling such a tremendous amount of achievement. And it was the first time I'd really felt that, you know, like really valued and like I could join in, you know, with other people comfortably and all of that. It was a wonderful, wonderful 2 years actually for that. And then, and when I left, I was 23 and I started working in another kind of the same kind of vein, a Waldorf influenced residential school, but I didn't live there and it wasn't voluntary. And we were working with, you know, children with extreme, you know, challenging behavior, aggressive outbursts, violence, you know, not all the kids, but there was a lot of that. And I found that I really enjoyed that work. I really enjoyed the kind of camaraderie with the other people. And I had just come from Camp Hill and I was feeling more confident. I thought, yes, this is great. This is what I want to do. I really love it, you know, and there were more kind of like-minded people. But I was still, you know, I was still really struggling with self-doubt and depression and a lot of anxiety. And I would go out a lot, you know, like a few times a week I'd go out drinking. And I'd be able to get up the next day and go to work and stuff like that. It never, you know, impinged on my life in that way. But it was definitely a massive crutch that I felt I needed at the time. And I definitely had a bit of a wild streak as well, which I know is very common when you have ADHD, you know, like rebellious and all of that. And I would do kind of like mad things just to get a reaction. I remember loving people's reactions and feeling like, oh, well, this is what I have to offer the world, I suppose, doing kind of mad stuff. So that went on for a few years. And where are we now? So that was kind of mid-20s. And then I was made team leader in one of the houses in the residential school where I lived, or I worked. And that was like, wow, you know, I've peaked. That felt amazing to be acknowledged for that, you know, to be a line manager in such a big school and stuff. That was really wonderful. And I really felt like this is going the right direction. And in many ways it was. But I still wasn't addressing the underlying things that were driving me. You know, I was in charge of doing the children's medicines, and some of them were pretty hardcore medicines, like epilepsy medicines and stuff. And I would just check it and double check it and double triple check it and quadruple check it and stuff, because I thought, oh, well, you know, Shun, you're daft. You know, you could end up giving the wrong medication and stuff. And luckily I never made a mistake, but I was very anxious, and that kind of stuff would keep me up at night. Like, what if I did this wrong? What if I did that wrong? And of course there was always the, you know, oh, you know, so-and-so said this a few days ago, and it was the way they said it that made me think that I did something wrong and they don't like me. And it was just like, and really, you know, awful thoughts. And people with ADHD will recognize that kind of rumination tendency. That was all going on as well the whole time, you know, from primary school up to then. And it just feels like there's, you know, you're going about your daily life and you're trying to live like everybody else. But, you know, you don't know it because you don't talk to people about it, because a lot of people around you don't struggle with these things. So you just carry on and you're trying to fit in and you're thinking, why can't I do this as easily as the other people? And why is everything so hard for me? And it just feels really, you know, your confidence is so low when you have undiagnosed ADHD, because you don't know where to start to get help or anything like that. But I think I lost my train of thought there a minute ago, but anyway, it'll come back, I'm sure. So yeah, all of that was going on, all of the kind of emotional difficulties that you have, you know, with ADHD. And so that was, yeah, that was working in that place. And then I got married, and that was like a big, it was definitely something that we rushed into. And now I can see it was quite impulsive. And at the time I did, of course, I didn't know that, but I remember thinking, you know, I'm going to, you know, I remember feeling like it'll elevate me somehow in society if I look more like an adult. I look more like an adult if I'm getting married or if I'm married, because I didn't feel like an adult. I felt like a little child, incapable. And I remember like telling people, oh, I'm getting married. And just in my head, I'd be like, that sounds really daft. You're like, you're 15 in your mind or something, you know? So I was always cutting myself down. Sorry, I was cutting myself down, you know, in these moments. And I was having therapy at the time, and I remember, which was, you know, a massive, massive help for sure. And that, I think I had therapy for about, well, 2 years, definitely every week for about 2 years. And that helped enormously, but I still had, you know, a long, long way to go. And I couldn't have gone that long way, you know, I couldn't at the time without the diagnosis, because I would go around in circles all the time. So yeah, we got married and it was kind of rushed, and we left. We were working together in that residential home, and then, well, yeah, I was living in Manchester next, and then I had my son, and I remember that was very surreal too. It was like, oh gosh, here, you know, do you feel this really feels like I'm an adult. This looks like I'm an adult, I think is the right way to put it, but it doesn't always feel like it. I know a lot of people don't feel like adults, you know, but with ADHD, there's often like a 30% delay in brain development. So, you know, a younger child, like a 12-year-old, might have sort of capacity of a 9-year-old, you know, with learning and emotional regulation and all of those kind of things. So, you know, you do kind of feel like you're younger, and there's good reason for it. So yeah, but you know, again, motherhood was a huge leap in sort of, you know, seeing what I was capable of. I mean, that was incredible, you know, like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm a parent now. That's amazing. And it was amazing. And it was a huge turning point for me in my life, with self-belief. And I, you know, I was able to, I guess, respect myself a bit more, because I, you know, I'd spent years telling myself that I was useless and would never come to anything, and I had no self-belief. So, you know, this changed everything, and that was wonderful. And then, you know, moving over to Prague and stuff, and all that's happened, you know, in the meantime. And I remember, I think it was, I had, what should I call it? I had, got distracted there. I kept thinking that I had PTSD because of that, you know, what I went through in those 2 years of total fear every day and humiliation from that nun. I thought, I must have PTSD. That must be why I don't remember stuff. Because I always had this thing like, oh, I read things, but I forget about them straight away. Or I don't read books. What else was I thinking about? I'd be like, oh, I don't like being in groups. I'm very anxious. It's like, we lived kind of not too far from the airport here in Prague. And I remember at the time, like hearing a plane coming into land, sometimes I would really feel like this fight or flight in my mind, like, oh my god, it's going to crash into, you know. And that would happen like every 10 minutes or so. And so it was and you know, I mean, the anxiety, there are peaks and troughs for sure, and it's not always the same level, at least it hasn't been for me throughout my life. And with depression as well, it sort of goes up and down. And I decided to go to a psychiatrist. So I found an English-speaking psychiatrist here, made an appointment. And, you know, I went thinking I'm going to get a diagnosis of PTSD. So I told him all about the nun and this and that. And he kept on asking me these questions like, are you an organized person and all of this? And I was like, I didn't think anything of it at the time. But he, yeah, so we went, So at the end of the kind of assessment, he got me to fill out questionnaires and stuff. And he said, I think you have ADHD. And I remember just being absolutely floored because I had spent years working with, you know, children and young adults with, you know, mainly with autism, but, you know, ADHD as well, and many behavioral difficulties and stuff. And I thought, there's no way I would have missed that. I must have, you know, that can't be true. And so, you know, further assessments showed that, yes, indeed, it was very true. And I just remember the feeling of like the ground fall away from underneath me. Like, I can't believe I've been going through life thinking I was just like everyone else in a way. My brain worked the same as everyone else's. And all along it had been different. Like it was just such a surreal kind of realization, a very strange kind of realization. There was a lot of relief there because I knew then that I wasn't stupid. You know, it was just that school didn't, you know, school is made for, you know, very neurotypical people. And there was no, at the time, you know, it's different now, but at the time there was no deviation at all. You were either good at school or you weren't. That was that. So there was a lot of peace came with it, a lot of like acceptance and the anxiety and moods and all of those things started making so much sense. And I felt less lost in the world. It's like, gosh, I've got a label. And for me, I was really happy to have that label. It was a wonderful label, even though I had difficulty in accepting it. And I didn't tell, you know, friends till, you know, a couple of years later, probably, because I felt embarrassed by it too. You know, I felt there, you know, there's a stigma, isn't there, with not being like everyone else. So I definitely felt that stigma and, you know, all the mental health problems that come with it. You just, you know, you generally don't talk about stuff like that. But, you know, looking back now, being diagnosed was the best thing ever, because I was able to address things. I was able to educate myself on more on ADHD and what, you know, how it shows up, and just like reading other people's stories as well really, really helped, because you don't feel so alone anymore. And so it, you know, the first few months were definitely bumpy after finding out, but since then, I mean, life has improved massively, you know, and it's changed everything. And I've become a bit obsessed with ADHD, and that's why I'm training to be a coach. But it's just, I don't know. I like, for all the difficulties and challenges and despair that can come with, you know, having ADHD and not knowing about it, there's a lot of experience to be gained from it, you know. You kind of, you know, you do get resilient, I suppose, from fitting in and just being like, well, I'm here and I've got to get on with life anyway. And
you know what? I wouldn't be who I am today if I hadn't gone through all of those things, all of those challenges and, you know, triumphs along the way. So, and interestingly, I went back to the psychiatrist recently who diagnosed me 4 years ago, and he was asking me a whole load of other questions. And at the end, he was like, you're a totally different person on paper than you were 4 years ago. Which was really, you know, really great to hear in many ways, just to get that feedback about how things have changed for me. Because I do feel like a totally different person now after having a diagnosis and getting information and training as a coach and, you know, using all of everything that we learn about in coaching, I use it myself, and it has made a tremendous difference to my life. And it's great to know that there is help out there and there is hope. There is hope for people with ADHD. And that's the message that I want you to leave with. And that is that life can get better. You just need to find the right way for yourself to make that happen. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Although there's still a long way to go in terms of gender justice, I really believe that talking about stuff helps. Raising awareness helps. And I really think that also, I mean, personally, I felt so much shame for having ADHD when I found it, when I was diagnosed. I was ashamed for, you know, for a good while. And I didn't tell anyone outside of my family, really, for a couple of years. And that just shows me, that's not a reflection of me being a bad person. That's just, that's stigma. That's what stigma makes you do. It stops you from, you know, being yourself. It stops you from seeking help. And those are so important. And I really believe that, you know, shame needs secrecy. And when you say things out in the open, it dispels that shame. And I don't feel ashamed anymore. And that's been a massive change in my life, on my journey after being diagnosed. And I do, like, and of course, I have my moments when I think back on me as a young child growing up and a young adult with so much shame for my, what I perceive to be shortcomings and inabilities and, you know, being stupid, believing that I was stupid and that I'd never come to any good. And I know that that's because of undiagnosed ADHD. So if you want to know a bit more about what I do, or you just want to reach out and say how, you know, with a comment about this episode, what it brought up for you, if you feel the same, if you've been affected in any way by this, I want to hear from you. Just reach out. You can reach me through my website. That's shunprochaska.com. It's written, it should be below this podcast in the blurb. You can follow me on Instagram at uniquely_wired_ADHD coaching on Instagram. And I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening. The music was by @miserable_Martin. That's his Instagram handle. And I will see you next time. Bye.